what does it feel like to leave a highly respected Fortune 500 company in a senior executive job to become an entrepreneur?
The beginnings of choosing to do something that goes against your instinct, choosing to do something that truly was a departure from a big part of who I'd been identity-wise, was hard.
That's Dave Hollis, CEO of The Hollis Company. After 17 years with Walt Disney, culminating in a role as president of worldwide distribution, Dave went into business with his wife, who had an amazingly successful company. Rachel is a New York Times bestselling author, motivational speaker, and social media influencer. What made Dave make that change? He was inspired by Rachel's personal journey to passionately help others to live their best, most authentic lives. He embarked on his own journey of leadership in life, pushing himself to stretch from his home base of a fixed mindset to an all-in growth mindset. Dave seeks ways to push himself, adapt, and grow, redefining what's possible. Together, he and Rachel are growing the Hollis Company at an exponential rate, all founded on the belief that everyone is made for more.
The point is, as you're able to pick a thing to do that you don't think you can, to show yourself what you're actually capable of. Once you have the proof that you're capable of that thing, it unlocks the possibility that you're capable of anything.
I'm Merrill McDonald, and my passion is helping people and organizations navigate the human struggle of change. I believe that when we relinquish control, we open up amazing new possibilities. This podcast, Let Go and Lead, is about what happens when we loosen the reins. In it, I speak with business leaders, academics, and creative thinkers to hear about their career and life journeys and gather what they've learned about change, transformation, and creativity along the way. And now, Dave Hollis. Hi, Dave. Thanks so much for doing this. I'm so excited. I'd love to have you tell our listeners, what is the Hollis Company and what's your real central purpose?
Sure. So I work with my wife, Rachel Hollis, at a place called The Hollis Company, where we exist to put tools in people's hands or experiences in their lives that, if they were to indulge in them, might give them the tools to engineer a better life for themselves. We create a ton of content, and the hope behind the content is to help people stay out of their own way, help people appreciate the kind of control they actually have in their life, the insight that we might be able to provide them when it comes to motivation or mindset or anything, frankly, that currently keeps them from reaching for the fullest version of their life, that with those tools maybe unlocks the passion that they have to bring light into this world, to serve with the tools that they've been afforded, to fully unlock and tap into their potential. And so we've been doing this together since June of last year in Austin, Texas. But truly, as much as we have had an amazing 18 months, it's a testament to the 15 or so years that my wife, who was the entrepreneur who is the founder of this company and who for the decade and a half tried things and learned from mistakes that she made, tried things and followed the breadcrumbs of what was working. And over the course of her entrepreneurial journey, created a relationship with an audience that left the clues for what she might write about in Girl Wash Your Face and Girl Stop Apologizing. And everything that we've ended up creating in the last 18 months is very much a response to a request that's come from the audience.
You mentioned Rachel, and I think any of us who followed Rachel would certainly describe her as fearless. And I wonder, having been beside her all these years, what's that been like to be living with someone as fearless as she is?
Well, what's interesting is I actually think that she would describe herself not so much as fearless, but a person who's willing to do it in the face of fears. I think she has courage in the face of doing things that are fear-inducing. She's, you know, pushed herself to be really vulnerable in the work that she's doing and pushed herself into spaces where she did not know the answer and how to pull it off. And she did it anyway. For example, Girl Wash Your Face has been a very successful book for her. It's almost sold 4 million copies since it came out in the spring of 2018. And the response is a validation that she was onto something. And when I read the book for the first time, I was certain, absolutely certain that it was a mistake to be as honest, to be as vulnerable, to own the things that she was owning, in part because I'd been in this place of trying to manage expectations and manage optics in a world where I felt like we'd spent most of our adult lives trying to tell a story that would make other people feel comfortable. She was doing something that was radically discomforting to me and ultimately disruptive to what people normally do in the world that we live inside of. And thankfully, she didn't listen to those concerns. And I can say 18 months into us doing this, it took a lot of work to get from a place of letting fear be my first impulse, as opposed to it's going to be scary, but let's do it anyway.
Yeah. And I love that whole distinction of being afraid, but doing it anyway, which I think is what courage is all about, right?
Oh, yeah.
What got you there? What happened in 18 months that you switched?
Well, I mean, so many things happened. I know we'll get to why I left the career that I had for 2 decades plus in entertainment, but so much of what precipitated me coming into this partnership with my wife was this interest in being pushed into places where I could grow. Though I was making this deliberate choice, though I knew the outcome I was hoping for, though I was positive that the choppy waters that I was pushing my boat out into were the thing that I needed, I had a lifetime, my entire adult life, of muscle memory of trying to control outcomes and limit disruption and cling to a commodity and certainty that for me was a prevailing North Star in almost the entirety of my adult life. And so the beginnings of choosing to do something that goes against your instinct, choosing to do something that truly was a departure from a big part of who I'd been identity-wise for the first 20 years of me being an adult, was hard. It is hard. It's hard to choose getting outside of your comfort zone. It's hard making a decision to do something that no one will necessarily understand. I needed to be able to show myself that, you know what, you can be uncomfortable and survive.
And let's go back. I think it's really interesting for our audience to understand the job you left, because you left a major executive position at Disney as president of the theatrical distribution group. And that's what many, many people would think would be something they'd aspire to as the pinnacle of their success. So when you're talking about making the leap, it was a big leap, right? And to a very different type of business model as well.
It was about as big a leap as you could make. And it was an interesting come together of circumstance. I had the opportunity over a 20 plus year span of time to work in entertainment. I started at Fox. I worked at an agency managing talent. I did some grassroots marketing. I ended up having my time at Disney. It was a 17-year career where the last 7 years, as you say, I was the head of sales for the movie studio, the film distribution chief, the president of distribution. And it was, on the outside, to anyone, it was the job that you hope to have at the end of your career, that once you get it, you do everything you can to keep it. And it is, like whether it was status-wise, connections-wise, the kind of things that it came with, it was to the outside world. It was absolutely the kind of like top of the mountain kind of thing. When I became the head of distribution, the company had just acquired Pixar. About 2 years later, they acquired Marvel Studios. And about 2 years later, they acquired Lucasfilm. And so as a person who was selling movies to theaters, to have Disney Animation, Pixar, Marvel Studios, and Lucasfilm as the collection of film product that you are bringing to movie theaters who desperately need Avengers and Star Wars movies, made the work a thing that was not necessarily a stretch. And the absence of the stretch was having a real impact on how satisfied I felt with the job, in part because that like top of the mountain status nature of what it meant to be in that role was, again, also inversely related to how I felt about how hard it was for me to get the accolades. And I mean, we broke every record. The Walt Disney Company is the greatest company on earth. And I worked with the best people, the greatest storytellers. I had the best team. But the combination of those factors were complicit in making that experience for me one that just didn't force me to tap into the potential that was put in my being. I also happened to be crossing this interesting age threshold from my 30s to my 40s while I'm watching my wife show up so well for her life. When I stopped showing up for my life as she was reaching for the greatest version of hers, the chasm that was created between us and the opportunity that existed in working together came together serendipitously, providentially, whatever you want to call it, at one point in time where it was like, you know what? At the top of your game, Dave, where you are at the lowest personally, make this leap so that we can go chase what we know we've been put on this earth to go do, even though it's not going to make sense to anybody.
I just love this story because I think it's such a great insight for so many people who are in jobs that they stay in because it looks good to everybody else. And you've talked a lot about that too, of not living your life based on what other people think. And I remember you saying that the Disney job was very satisfying on the outside, but not as much on the inside.
Yeah. What's interesting, if you're listening and you are in a job where you feel stuck and any of the impulse to ask a bigger question about how you could best utilize the potential that's put in your body is in any way stifled by the worry of what other people might think of you making a choice that does not make as much sense to them, stop it. The people are not thinking about you. People were not thinking about me. People are thinking about themselves, and that does not make them bad. It makes them human. I waited longer than I should have to make a decision to go chase a thing that now for 18 months has produced the very best version of myself and has afforded me this opportunity to provide value on a scale that is unbelievably, wildly more fulfilling with my best friend and partner. I waited a year longer than I should have because I was worried what people would think about me making this choice. That was a wasted year. It was not only just a wasted year, but it was a year where I devolved because of my unfulfillment into a version of me as a husband and into a version of me as a father that I'm not proud of. You just can't worry about it. You got to be honest with yourself about how the identity that you're taking on in the workplace, in the home, whatever it might be, matches the fulfillment, the satisfaction that you have in knowing that you've taken everything that you have been given talent-wise and are deploying it in the work that you're doing right now. If that's disconnected, there's a length of time where you can be okay with that being disconnected. But long-term, it is a recipe for unfulfilling disaster. And the chance, frankly, that you'll get to the end of your life and look back and wonder what might have been if only you'd have pushed yourself into a position to fully utilize the potential that you have.
Yeah, I'm a huge believer in that. And I think every job I've ever left, people always ask, why did you do that? But it, you know, if you hang on to something great, you can't move on to the next thing. So I think it's just terrific.
What's interesting for me, too, in real time, we have a monthly leadership meeting. We talk about what's, you know, on the schedule here at the Hollis Company for the next month. And this last one was a 2020 forecasting, vision casting kind of session. We were talking about where we're headed as a company for this coming year. And when it came to each person, we asked them to do both like their business goals, but also some personal goals. And when it came to me, as much as I'm the CEO of the company, I did the same exercise. And when I got to my personal goals, one of the things that I represented, which was interesting, and I, without even preparing it, it just kind of fell out of my mouth. I recognize that I have this book that's coming out this next year. And in it, I talk about the kind of transition from Disney into the Hollis Company and what those identity shifts meant. But one of the things that will happen for me in this next year is I will be done telling the story of leaving the Walt Disney Company. It's a thing when I was leaving that I thought would never, ever be a thing that I could not have come up in conversation, that would always forever be a part of my identity. And as much as it is an interesting story, and I want to talk about it, and certainly because of how much the book also includes some stories around it, sure, I'm going to talk about it. But I am transitioning into a chapter of life where that will be a thing that happened to have happened, but will not be a central part of the story of who I am and how I'm delivering value. And if you're right now listening to this and you've convinced yourself that the character that you play and the story of your life is forever attached to your station in life today, that is a limiting belief.
And tell us about the new character you're creating.
It's still being formed. When I originally came into being supportive of Rachel and this company, having been a leader of sales, the work that I did inside of a more corporate role would be this great balance for her as the face of the company, as the creative. She's the chief creative officer and founder. Like, I was going to play a role that was more about being behind the scenes and supportive so that we could unlock all of the value that comes in her creation. And dang it, there's so much. And here I am now 18 months in, and I can tell you that I 100% still want to tap into and have that a part of my, you know, unfair advantage for this company. But also, I'm really enjoying finding my voice as someone who can also teach and also do the kind of work that she does, but from a completely different perspective. She is someone who was growth mindset at birth. I have been fixed mindset my entire life. And because of that difference, when I talk about how I had to overcome some of the things that I had limiting the way I thought I could do certain things, there's a certain part of our audience that just will relate more to my mindset versus hers.
Yeah, it's really interesting because when I heard you speak, one of the things that really struck me was the power of freeing yourself from what you're afraid of. Like, as you were talking about having been behind the scenes and now more up front, it just felt like something amazing had clicked. And you could feel it in the whole audience of 7,000 people responding to that. Like, oh my gosh, I want that for myself.
Yeah. It's been a journey. You know, like, what part of it is, Rachel decided that vulnerability and authenticity was going to be a part of how she organized the company culturally, but also in terms of the kind of tools that she was putting into the universe. Long before I became comfortable with the idea of authenticity and vulnerability as a part of how I would also play a role. And so the transition, this 18 months has also been me having first with Training Wheels started doing some small stuff with a morning show, with some vlog footage, with a few social posts that was like just becoming comfortable being more honest. I mean, honestly, at the beginning, it was more like curated honest, where it was like, I'm going to tell you something that I think will make you think that this is me being honest, but it wasn't totally honest, right? And now we are, I would argue, some of the most honest people that you're going to find, because when something is going on in our life, we tend to just turn on a microphone, we tend to turn on a screen and capture it in real time. And in capturing it, the great news is, it ends up being really valuable content for people who are interested in having someone start a conversation for them. Sometimes the tool isn't so much the thing, like our solution to an issue may in fact not be the thing that works for you as the listener. But the fact that we worked through it may be the prompt for you to have a conversation that you felt uncomfortable or anxious, or if you're in any way codependent, like not wanting to upset the other person. If listening to us work out our stuff affords you the chance of having a way into working out yours, our work here is done.
Do you think about leadership differently than you had in your previous roles? Like, how would you compare and contrast the way you lead today?
Oh my goodness, so differently. There's a chapter in my book where I ended up trying to write a version of Rachel's very successful Girl Wash Your Face, which is her telling 20 lies that she believed and how in taking those lies and turning them into truth, she was able to stay out of her way. I wrote the same kind of thing, but through that lens of someone who has a different mindset, motivated differently, skeptical of all the things. One of the chapters, one of my lies is, what got me here will get me there. And if anything, the chapter is a study on the mistake that I made of thinking that the corporate environment that I came out of, that the leadership style that I employed, the way that I handled what at the time was about a 1,000-person team would work on a team of four, on a team of 44, 54, bad, bad thinking. There was so many things that used to work there that don't work here. And the biggest thing for me, as a person who was managing a bigger team, where I'd been placed over and over in my experience at Disney into teams where I had less experience than many of the people on the team. So I had the benefit of learning from them, of entrusting that they would be able to kind of lead on behalf of the initiative of the team or the want of my boss. And that my job was to handle the outside stakeholders so that my people, my team, could get their stuff done and done well. And I had the best teams in the business, period. So I flew it, at 50,000 feet and had a rule where if you, as a leader, had an issue, you had to come with a solution or a couple of solutions and a recommendation as to why you prefer solution one over solution two. I'd help, affirm that the rationale that you're using is good, and then you'd go implement, and I'd continue to kind of keep the wolves at bay. And so I realized, look, I can't float at this higher level. I got to roll my sleeves up, get my nails dirty, be involved in the every single step so that I can get ahead of, like, predict the kind of problems that are going to come up before they actually happen. Rachel, I give her a lot of credit because she's the founder, because for these 15 years, she's been working on growing and creating the business that we have, can do the job of every person who works on this team. I came out of an environment where I worked in publicity for a bit. I worked in marketing a bit. I worked in, obviously, sales. But I don't have a lot of competency in a whole bunch of the stuff that we're doing as a company. And so I had to really humble myself and appreciate that the only way I could be successful was to actually learn how to do every single role that every single employee here does.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're learning new things every day, which is really exciting. That's great.
It's hourly. I mean, daily. I mean, if I only learn one thing a day, then something has gone wrong.
I should have known better. So there's so many directions I could go, but I'd love to come back to a mantra that you and I both share, which is that the most important story you tell is the one you tell yourself. You've talked a little bit about that, but I'd just love to have you put a finer point on it.
Well, I'm going through this very interesting experience in real time with the idea of how much I think I can do or what I think I can do. My wife and I just recently did the most challenging physical thing that we've ever done. We are big on pushing ourselves into endurance kind of situations so that we can together train, and that the experience of conquering something like a half marathon or a marathon is a thing that will bring us together. We just climbed a mountain 13 times over, so that in having ascended 13 times, we would have climbed the equivalent of climbing Mount Everest, 29,000 feet of ascension. It was the hardest thing we've ever done. And in having accomplished it, the experience fundamentally changed the way I think about what I can physically endure. And coming off of that experience, as much as I'd been a runner, I got back out on the roads after having been on this mountain climbing experience. And the idea of coming back to what previously was my standard, running about 5 miles on a Saturday, was ridiculous. I just went through having climbed 13 times, which took about an hour and a half, 13 consecutive 90-minute workouts, made me going on a run for 50 minutes feel small. And so I'd rewired in my mind what I was capable of physically, and all of a sudden, my 5 miles has become 8.5 or 9. In my personal life, where my coping mechanism was, in a lot of ways about pain mitigation, discomfort mitigation, I would pick up a drink at the end of a long day to just smooth off the rough edges of a long day. And in doing it, I was eliminating the ability to fully take advantage of the discomfort that you want to experience so that you can actually grow. So I made this choice. Look, I'm going to stop drinking for a year just to show myself that I can. And as much as, now I'm 5 or so months into not having a drink, it's not a thing I think about at all, except that after having been a casual drinker for 20 or so years of my life, that I decided to do something that I never frankly thought that I would do has given me another fact that I can do things that I don't think I can accomplish. And so if you're listening and you're like, okay, so you can climb a mountain, you can drink. No, you're missing the point. The point is, as you're able to pick a thing to do that you don't think you can, to show yourself what you're actually capable of, once you have the proof that you're capable of that thing, it unlocks the possibility that you're capable of anything. And so, especially having come out of this place of being fixed mindset oriented my entire life, I am now in pursuit of things I don't think I can do for the opportunity to either succeed and change the narrative, I can now do this thing I didn't think I could do, or to intentionally find a thing that I can fail at for the benefits that come from failing and learning from the failure. And so reorienting the way that I think about the pursuit of hard things has completely changed the story of my life. I am not afraid of walking into a hard season. I go into it knowing that it will be difficult, but because I can appreciate the kind of fruit that will come out of the difficulty, it just totally changes the way that I think about the experience and what I hope to get out of it.
And that's a lot, I think, of what your book is about, isn't it?
My book is called Get Out of Your Own Way, A Skeptic's Guide to Growth and Fulfillment. And my book is this attempt to take 20 examples of times when I was in my own way, whether it was through self-sabotage, whether it was through just believing something that was absolutely fundamentally not true. I go through a series of stories that try to, you know, give the reader, the listener, if they're listening on audio, to some examples of things that I think are going to be unbelievably universal in like being relatable, but that as you're able to relate and can see how I just took the power out of that lie or flipped that lie into a truth, maybe is something that you can apply to your life as well. But, you know, I get a lot into identity, my work being who I am, or that my worth and my business card or my worth and my title are somehow connected. That, you know, certainly is a big part of what I talk about. The idea of this relationship that I have with my wife, where my identity in this relationship has fundamentally changed because of, in one way, what had for many, many years of our relationship had me as the breadwinner and me as the person who had the job that was, to the outside world, status-wise, at a different level than hers. Our roles have completely flipped. My wife is the breadwinner of our family. My wife is wildly more known and has more status as she deserves because of the work that she's done with her books on stages and, frankly, everything else that she's done. But for me, it was jarring. I mean, really jarring. And I like one of the chapters is if she does not need me, she will not want me. It's really a very interesting study in like the ridiculous way that our brains sometimes associate the kind of tangible things that we can contribute to a relationship as being like the price of entry for the love that we're hoping to get back. And when my wife didn't need my salary to help support the ambitions of scaling her business, it was a very strange, like back to seventh grade and some weird rejection kind of insecurity of, man, if she doesn't need me, will she still want me? Good news, she still wants me. But because, you know, like I had to do some work, you know, whether it was therapy, a lot of conversation with her or both, like there's a lot of stories that are just basically, I believed things that were not true, that absolutely were tied to insecurity or fear or mindset. And in hopefully telling these stories, it helps people, if they struggle with these things too, get past the struggle and have a freer, fuller life.
And this kind of leads me to a question that I ask everyone, because, of course, the whole area of our podcast is around let go and lead. What is it you think leaders most need to let go of?
Well, we've kind of talked about them a little bit, but I think it's a great way to end because it's a twofold thing for me. The first thing that you have to let go of is the worry of how other people who've previously done your job, how your peers have done your job, what they will think of you doing the job differently than the way it's ever been done. You have to let go of the opinions of other people, the worry of what they're thinking about, the way that you might be perceived if you were to do X or Y. If nothing else is evident in the way that certain businesses have broken away from the traditional businesses, it's that they were thinking in ways that were a complete deviation from the standard. And the second thing is, you need to let go of the worry of what will happen if you fail. Every person that you admire, every leader that you admire, every company that you admire, anything you admire is the byproduct of someone who is willing to take a chance, put themselves in a position to fail. In failing, learn from those mistakes and grow through the benefit of having made them so that they can become better.
Well, Dave, I'm so excited to be watching everything you guys are doing and looking forward to seeing what's next. And thanks so much for being on our podcast.
I appreciate you having me on, Meryl, and really appreciate the chance to, you know, connect and hang out with somebody who's trying to push people into reaching for better versions of themselves. I love the idea of let go and lead. So thanks for having me on.
How inspiring is Dave Hollis? He's living proof that someone with a fixed mindset can retrain their brain and unleash a growth mindset. Three lessons really stood out to me from my conversation with Dave. First, follow your own path. Don't get hung up on what others think of you, the way you do your job, your career decisions, etc. Follow your path to whatever wild fulfillment means for you. Second, recognize the power of adapting your leadership style to your environment. Whether it's keeping the wolves at bay or digging in deep, know where you add value and where you can work to add more value. Third, reorient the way you think about pursuing hard things. In pursuing them, you will either succeed, change your narrative, or fail and learn. Go in knowing it may be difficult. Appreciate the experience you will gain as you strive for the outcome. Dave's new book is titled Get Out of Your Own Way, A Skeptic's Guide to Growth and Fulfillment. Dave, I can't wait to read it when it comes out next year. Thank you so much for being with us. If you enjoyed this conversation, please remember to subscribe to automatically receive upcoming episodes. Thanks for being with us.